Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as most of you know, we've begun our 30 Issues in 30 Days election series. Let others focus only on the horse race. We're tackling 30 different issues in 30 shows between now and the election. We completed our first set of six issues yesterday that were all about jobs. We looked at the long-term unemployed, economic growth, K through 12 education, college education, unions, and free trade. Now, every Friday during this series, we'll do follow-up Friday segments on things that came up during the week. And one thing that keeps coming up when we talk about American jobs and education is Chinese jobs and education. So we will go live to Hong Kong now to talk to a journalist who may be uniquely positioned to compare the two countries, Keith Bradshaw. For many years, he covered Detroit and the auto industry for the New York Times. Now he is the Hong Kong bureau chief. And Keith, thanks so much for taking the time for us. Hello from New York.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
And, of course, China and the auto industry are in the news together right now because of President Obama's formal complaint against China at the World Trade Organization for subsidizing cars and auto parts that it exports. And, of course, he announced it on the campaign trail in automaking country in Ohio. What has China's reaction been to this charge of illegal protectionism?
China's reaction has been uncommonly quiet. There was a commentary in the official state news agency Xinhua in rather muted terms decrying this particular filing by the United States. But even though they were expecting this to happen, because there had been a lot of agitation in favor of this by lawmakers from auto-producing states, they haven't actually had a real formal response. And I think a big part of that is they're very distracted right now with the confrontation with Japan and then with their own leadership struggle.
One of the topics in 30 Issues was free trade in general on yesterday's show, and the debate over whether open borders for capital creates more jobs for the U.S. or just lets automakers and many other companies outsource jobs. Do you see China as being very pro-free trade in general because they gain so many manufacturing jobs from it?
Absolutely. Overall, they have been committed at least as a principle to free trade. Now, that said, they have come into the free trade system with a pretty good deal in the sense that from the point of view of protecting their own markets to the extent that they want to do that, when they were admitted to the World Trade Organization, it actually took effect in 2001, but a lot of the terms had been negotiated through the 90s when they were really still more of a developing country. As a result, they were allowed to keep relatively high barriers to imports while getting guaranteed access to all these other markets all over the world. So, for example, the United States tariff on imported cars is 2.5%. The Chinese tariff on imported cars is 20%. So they are very committed to free trade, but within the terms on which it's currently being done, which have provided greater access for their goods to foreign markets than they have for foreign goods to the Chinese market.
It's an interesting phrase that you use, and it's very similar to what's on Romney's website in the category on free trade. It says, "I am for free trade on terms favorable to America." And, you know, in theory, free trade would be open the borders and let the chips fall where they may. But he says free trade on terms favorable to America. You're saying, therefore, they are for free trade on terms favorable to China. So that actually sums up a lot of what these kinds of negotiations are about. Keith, we talked on Wednesday's show about the decline of private sector unions in this country. Is there a union movement in China in the manufacturing sector or anywhere else?
There is a state-sponsored national union system, which exists to a considerable extent to help the state and companies prevent the development of independent unions and to help coordinate the setting of wages. The Chinese government has not allowed the appearance of truly independent unions, although you are getting more attempts by workers at a number of factories to organize, for example, what are called local units of the national state-sponsored union, but may at times behave with a little more independence than perhaps was the case in the past. But overall, you do not have any trace yet of anything that would resemble, for example, solidarity 3 decades ago in Poland.
So how do workers in manufacturing have any bargaining power for decent wages and working conditions?
There are not enough workers. And as a result, factories bid for workers. Wages are rising faster in China than practically any other country in the world. You're seeing 20% annual increases in wages for the last few years. How, and if workers don't get the increases they want, they leave with their feet. You have a lot of factories that can't operate at full capacity because they struggle to get enough workers because they haven't raised their wages quickly enough.
They have a billion people and they can't find enough workers?
It's extraordinary. The tipping point, the turning point, seems to have been, actually it's called the Lewis point by economists, seems to have been in 2007. When a study by the Ministry of Agriculture actually found in 3/4 of the villages in China, and this was a massive national survey, they said there were essentially no more able-bodied young workers who could migrate to cities to take factory jobs. So they have expanded the manufacturing sector so much, they now have the world's largest manufacturing sector, bigger than the United States and bigger than Germany, that they have absorbed that labor. At the same time, also, you've got now, because of the one-child policy, you're beginning to have some shrinkage in the number of young people in these younger age cohorts. And then finally, you have improving education, so a lot of people don't necessarily want to sit 10 hours a day on a long bench doing the same assembly tasks. So in order to persuade workers to do that, you have had this rather rapid growth in wages over the last few years. But even then, it's off such a low base. I mean, it's paying somebody an extra 20% when their wage is $300 a month, okay, that may be an extra $60 that you're paying them, but even $360 a month is a very low wage by American standards and by the standards of any developed country.
We're comparing China and the U.S. on some of the things in the news this week and some of the topics in our 30 issues segments about jobs and education with Keith Bradshaw, who covers Hong Kong for the New York Times and used to cover the U.S. auto industry. Keith, with all the talk this week about the 47% who Mitt Romney says pay no income taxes and feel like victims and lack personal responsibility, does China have an income tax?
Yes, it does. And as in the case in the United States, it doesn't kick in until you start reaching higher levels of income. I don't know what the current percentage of the Chinese population is that pays the income tax, but it's actually a smaller percentage than that 53% in the United States. However, that doesn't mean that the rest of the Chinese public is not being taxed. In fact, in some ways, they're being taxed heavily. First of all, you've got a 17.5% value-added tax. That's basically a fancy name for a more complicated kind of sales tax. That's why so many Chinese tourists, when they come to Hong Kong or New York City, if they can afford to do it, what they really want to do is go shopping because they're avoiding that 17.5% tax. If they're buying something imported, there's another often 20% import tax. They're paying 40% tax on a lot of things they buy. That's one reason why Chinese consumers don't spend it the same way within China that, for example, Americans or Europeans do. Second of all, there are some hidden taxes in China, what's called financial repression, which is that the banks pay you a very low rate of interest, and if you're in China, you have very few alternatives on where to put your money except for the bank. The stock market is not very well formed. There's not really a bond market, and you end up with a choice of putting your money in the bank or putting it into the real estate market. The banks are paying almost nothing, and then the banks lend it at a fat margin for the banks, and that money is then transferred, in effect, to the state-owned enterprises, which are part of the government, which are the only ones who can lend at also these regulated rates. So there are a lot of formal and informal taxes that fall on the, whatever it is, 60, 70, 80% of the population that's not paying income taxes in China.
Is there a Chinese Grover Norquist or any unhappiness with the taxation regime there?
There hasn't been a real anti-tax movement yet. And there are some economists who say this is ridiculous, that the particularly the 17.5% national sales tax is coming in for some criticism, partly because they repress dissent. You don't really know how many people are unhappy with it, but you don't hear that much. There are a lot of other issues. You hear a lot about problems with education, housing costs, and so forth. You don't hear a lot of complaints against the taxes. That said, a senior tax official from the ministry that handles taxation did say in a speech in Hong Kong about 2 weeks ago that they're looking to lower that 17.5% national sales tax to maybe 16% or 15%. And I should add that 17.5% tax, I mean, that covers everything to an extent that you don't see even in the States. So it's a very comprehensive tax.
And what do they get for their tax dollars in terms of a safety net? Is there welfare for the urban or rural poor? Is there Social Security and Medicare or the equivalent for the elderly?
There is very little in the way of a Social Security safety net. If you run out of money, then you need to hope that your family can support you because the government's not going to be there for you, and people who are poor in China are very poor indeed. They are beginning to provide the basics. I'll give you an example. Somebody I know, whom I'd done a profile of, was diagnosed with cancer, and his village did provide for all residents medical insurance. This was somebody who had a small business. He had 20 employees providing landscaping plants for the sides of highways.
Mm-hmm.
But the medical insurance, the lifetime cap per person was $5,000. And he went through $40,000 in chemotherapy. Fortunately, after six rounds of that, he is in remission, thank goodness. But in the process, he had to sell his business, sell his car, and move into a small apartment and lost most of his assets. And he was lucky that he could even afford that because he had the business, he had the car, he was one of the more prosperous people in the village. This is one reason why 80% of new car buyers in China have never bought a car before. There's so little instability. There's so much instability in the middle class.
Hmm.
You can be prosperous one day and something goes wrong and there's nothing between you and financial ruin.
Why is there so little safety net? It's supposed to be communist China, which is all about safety net, isn't it?
It is, and yet they've just been very cautious. One of the things Chinese officials tell you is they're cautious about ending up in a situation like the United States or Europe, where they have a very expensive social safety net because they don't think they're a wealthy enough country yet that they can afford it. They also like having a very high savings rate, which results in further holding down the interest rate and means there's a lot of money washing around that can be used to build new factories, to create jobs, to build roads, and so forth. So people aren't spending on consumption, partly because consumption is taxed at 17.5%, and partly just because they never know when the next bombshell in their life will wipe out their savings, so they want to save as much as they can. And then finally, they don't have much in the way of savings because they've only really been able to start saving in the last 30 years. Mm. Before that, under Mao, you weren't allowed to have savings, in effect.
And we did two of our 30-issue programs this week about education. And, we have this big debate in America about high-stakes standardized tests. I understand that China gives its students really high-stakes standardized tests, yes?
The Chinese test for getting into college, and for that matter, going through the school system, but particularly the one going into college, is absolutely brutal. People spent a whole year preparing for it. There have even been outrageous cases in which, for example, students even get IVs while they're studying that are supposedly enriched with various vitamins and extra oxygenation or something on the theory that's going to help them on their tests.
Here they just take speed.
There's nothing to compare. The SAT is Little League baseball compared to the amount of test preparation and stress that students in China go to.
Is that because slots in college are so rare, there's no national program to try to get as many Chinese college educated as they can, as we're discussing in this country?
Actually, there is, and the rate at which they have expanded the college education system is breathtaking. They have quadrupled the number of college graduates in the past 10 years. But here's the difficulty. How well you do on the test decides whether you end up going to Tsinghua or Beijing University, which are the Harvard and Yale of China, or whether you end up in a fourth-tier university from which it's going to be very difficult to get a job. What's more is that most of the universities in China are state-controlled, and the ones that are private tend to get state subsidies. The way the subsidy system works is that the better the university, the less you pay in tuition. So if you're going to a first-year university, it's actually very cheap. And if you're going to a fourth-tier university, your parents are borrowing, and you're struggling to afford it. So that puts a financial pressure on doing as well as possible on the national entrance exam, in addition to the pressure of just wanting to go to the best educational institution you can.
And I guess the stakes are so high in part because there's no Social Security equivalent, so there's a lot of elder poverty and a lot of people who aren't making that much money who, in addition to supporting their children, have to support their parents.
That's absolutely true, and even more adding to the pressure is the one-child policy. You get kids who have two parents and four grandparents all urging them on the day before they're taking the national entrance exam for university. They've had all those hopes riding on them for 18
years. On that one child. How about that?
We
just have 30 seconds left, and my guest has been Keith Bradshaw, New York Times Hong Kong bureau chief, comparing some of the issues we've been talking about in our presidential election series, 30 issues in 30 days, with how the same issues are dealt with in China. Just give me real quick political analysis. Romney is trying very hard to win votes by convincing Americans he would be tougher on China with respect to trade. Do they buy it in Beijing?
They're a little nervous about it, and they have had commentaries in the state media criticizing him for those policies. But they're not sure that Obama will be any better for them, given the way he's been filing more WTO cases as well lately as well.
So they don't think you don't get the sense that the Chinese government prefers one candidate to another in this race?
They have not clearly said that. They've had criticisms of both. I would say the criticisms have been a little more strong of Romney. But that's mostly because they have something specific to criticize in the currency. Now that they have this new WTO case, they'll start criticizing.
Keith Bradshaw, this has been fascinating. I really, really appreciate you taking the time from Hong Kong.